Thanks for listening to Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Zingari, and I just want you to know that we've edited this podcast for brevity, so you hear all the good stuff quicker. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. In 2018, former State Representative Kaya Morris withdrew her bid for re-election and stepped down from her seat at the State House, in large part because of the ongoing racist and threatening behavior she said she and her family were facing. The Vermont Attorney General's office investigated, and last week, Attorney General T.J. Donovan released his office's findings. Though he believes former State Rep Kaya Morris and her family are victims of racist harassment, Donovan said he won't be filing charges. A day after announcing his decision, he joined us on Vermont Edition, and when I asked Donovan if he thinks the system has failed Morris, he said the system can do better, and he cited a new bias incident reporting system he hopes will help. But Donovan also said there are ways beyond the criminal system that we need to be addressing racism, and that people in positions of power in Vermont, who he admitted are mostly white, male, and from a Christian background, have a very specific job.
We need to listen to people of color. We need to hear their experiences, and we need to validate their experiences. Without a doubt, that is the biggest thing we need to do, is to simply listen.
Today on the program, we want to offer a forum for sharing those experiences and for listening. Part of that means elevating voices of people who've been marginalized and amplifying that perspective. Joining us first is Connor Cyrus, a morning reporter for WCAX-TV, a Burlington and Plattsburgh-based news channel. Hi, Connor. Nice to have you here.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
I'm well. Sha'an Mulier is also with us. She's coordinator of I Am Vermont 2, an ongoing art project aimed at illuminating the perspective of Vermonters of color. Sha'an, it's nice to have you on the program.
Hi, thank you, Jane.
Beverly Little Thunder is a Lakota Two-Spirit elder from Standing Rock, North Dakota, who's lived in Vermont for 15 years. She's a board member of the Burlington-based Peace and Justice Center and advocacy organization. Beverly, I'm so glad you could be with us today.
Thank you. I'm glad that I could be here, too.
And also Tristan Tolino, a Brattleboro State representative who identifies as white and has been talking about what he and other white Vermonters can do to address systemic racism and microaggressions, both personally and professionally. Tristan, it's nice to have you in this panel as well. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I appreciate it.
Connor, you're here in the studio in Colchester with me. So let me ask you, first of all, to help open this conversation. You were recently featured on the podcast Brown and Out, which is an interview podcast that explores the experiences of queer Vermonters of color. And I listened to you in that podcast episode describe your experience with racism when you moved to Vermont and went to high school here, and how your experiences were dismissed. Can you describe a little bit about what you experienced and how then, when you tried to tell people in power what you were experiencing, how that went?
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, I was in high school, so I'm a 15-year-old. And I had never experienced racism or any type of discrimination in my life. You know, like, again, in the podcast, I talk about how I lived in Dallas before, and I knew I was black, but I didn't know I was black. And so when I came here and I experienced racism and I was called the N-word, I was pushed into lockers, I was given death threats, and nobody in the administration would listen to me. And I'm traveling through, and I'm trying, you know, when you're 15, you're trying to navigate life. All you want to do is fit in. You look for anything to fit in with your peers. I was an athlete. I did all these things, but I still never fit in because I was black. And that was one of the hardest things for me to grasp. And so when I'm experiencing all of this and I'm talking to the principal or the assistant principal at the time, and he dismissed everything that I had to say. And what he was able to do was turn it on me and say, Connor, I think you're sensitive. And I think that these situations are being exaggerated, and that really you need to understand the difference of being picked on versus being bullied. And it wasn't until it happened right in front of him, with a meeting in front of my mom, when a kid on a bike said, I'm going to kill you, blankety blank, you know, drop the N-word. That was when the conversation became real.
You don't sort of explicitly mention this in your telling of that story on Brown and Out, but it seems as well that what you're saying, too, is, you know, until this white assistant principal could experience it for himself, he didn't trust what you were saying. But it was like, oh, OK, well, if I've seen it, then it must be true. But yeah, if Connor says it, it's probably an exaggeration. Do you find that happens frequently?
Absolutely. And I'll tell you that if it wasn't for one teacher at the school and my mother, like, believing my story and believing my experiences, I can't say that I would turn out the same way. Because when you, again, are that age and you are trying to navigate life and nobody's believing you, and I did everything right when all of this stuff happened. I didn't fight back. I didn't yell at these kids. I just would take the fetal position or I would keep moving. And so when you do everything right and still you're being told that you're exaggerating, that's what I've had. That's what, as an adult, that's what I have the biggest problem with, is that when adults teach kids to do the right thing. That means not fighting back. That means talking to the teachers, addressing the situation, and really trying to not exacerbate a situation that's already bad. I did that, and I was ignored until it happened in front of them.
Sha'an, you come at this experience and this conversation that we're talking about today with racism in Vermont and how it feels and how it's experienced as an activist, as a parent, as someone who experiences racism yourself. And when you hear Connor talk about his school experience, does that resonate with you, with your experiences in St. Johnsbury as a parent?
Oh, Jane, yes, it does. My first experience was moving up from New York City, really understanding what I thought was racism on an individual level, on an institutional level. I hadn't recognized how it would affect my child. And that was my first experience being an advocate for him, starting with Head Start. So Head Start all the way through his school career, along with notable behaviors that today we certainly recognize as manifestations of stress, of manifestations of the capacity to not fully function based on your classroom experience. And Connor, I see you are an alum of LSC, and recently I was advocating for a student there around teachers, around where they assign you in your, whether it's internship, how they put you out into the community, that there is absolutely no support. When the dean of students is speechless and has no words, that's very disturbing.
And Sha'an, let me just, pardon the interruption, interrupt to say LSC, you're talking about Linden State, which of course now is Northern Vermont University at Linden, but please go on, just for people who weren't familiar with that acronym.
Thank you very much. Yes. Absolutely. And in the Northeast Kingdom, it's one of the schools, one of the main places where our human service workers are teachers, whether they're secondary educators, whether they're preschool to 12th grade, receive their education. And there is a lack of leadership in supporting not only the voices of their students of color, but how do you connect with the community? How do you connect with the larger network of folks of color that would allow you to be accountable? Be accountable to what it is that you are teaching. Are you, in fact, moving people forward, maintaining, sustaining, satiating yourself? Are you keeping people back? So, yes, I can very, and I say unfortunately, even recently in my own community where there, and that is in St. Johnsbury, where there was an effort, there was an initiative to support communities of color. And because of lack of adequate leadership and access, it didn't happen.
And Sha'an, before we talk to Beverly and Tristan, I want to ask you as well, you talk about that that lack of leadership, and I wonder if one of the consequences of Vermont being such a white state and having such a small population, relatively speaking, of people of color, is that there is that ability to to sort of slide through without accountability, or to occasionally not have to face a large chorus of voices saying, no, you have to do better on this issue. That when it's, you know, voices that can often either be diminished or pushed down, or there are only a few of them, that makes it harder to hold leadership accountable. Do you think that's true?
100%. We are socialized in a racially hierarchical socialization. Here in Vermont, when I say the lack of people of color, the lack of voices, and Connor said it wonderfully, that no one heard. So you don't hear from you're not heard as that preschool student, nor are you heard as a accomplished leader in your community when you're bringing in voices. The work that has been done, that had been done in the Northeast Kingdom, and I'll talk about Caledonia County especially, was done predominantly by white people. They're coming in once again with a point of view that, for me, sustains and maintains the status quo. And the struggles, not only for people of color in leadership, but for the ordinary person who wants to live and work here, how do we make it welcoming more than being polite? What are the things that need to be done to make this community enjoyable for all, safe for all, so that Kaya's experience, many of us have had that, not to her degree because of as a public figure, in our daily lives, and that's part of the tragedy of it, that this is something that we talk about stress, we talk about big stresses, divorce, house burnings, you know, death. And those are events that happen occasionally. The stress that both people of color and white folks experience around race is continually, and it impedes a healing process. It impedes us in going forward because we get stuck in that stress. Thank you, Jane.
Yeah, thank you, Sean. I appreciate it. And Tristan, I want to bring you in here because this is actually something that you've been thinking about, exactly what Sean is talking about, and this increasing awareness of your own privilege as a white man in Vermont is something that you've been thinking and writing about. You detailed it on your Facebook page. Especially, I would hope that maybe you could highlight an interaction that you had with a friend recently in a parking lot, because it was illuminating for you and maybe illuminating for others as well.
Yeah, thank you. I will speak to that, and I just wanted to offer first one sort of larger frame, which I think has been personally very useful to me, and that is to understand, yes, I'm a white man in a racially structured and gender-structured system that is largely designed to benefit me as a category above all others. And so that the learning journey that I and others are on is to understand what it means to be racist and socialized into a racist system, and to learn and understand how that affects our ability to be fully present and fully responsible for the ways that harms and diminishes our friends, our family, and our neighbors, and the people who are experiencing these traumas. And I've worked with Kaya and consider her a friend, and I have watched as she has suffered a horrible public version of this. But I also think it's incredibly important that we not be allowed, as a majority white state, to scapegoat a handful of individuals for their extreme behavior, when we have to understand that the norm in Vermont is of many, many types of interactions that diminish and traumatize people, and that's part of what we have to open ourselves up to with humility and with intention. And so my story, I'll try to summarize it very quickly. I ran a restaurant for years, and I had a beloved young man who worked for me and who I have been a mentor and a friend to for now a decade, and he's African American, and I saw him recently in the Brattleboro Food Co-op parking lot with his oldest daughter, who I think is 7. And I drove up alongside of him and I tried to get his attention. And I made a really dumb mistake, but it was an innocent mistake. And it speaks to the kinds of things that happen when you don't know your own privilege. And I pointed at him because I have this game with another friend who's all over town where I do sort of the point my fingers at my eyes and then point to him like, I see you. Mm-hmm. And I did that to my former cook. And he looked up, and at first he just saw me pointing, and his face went absolutely white with fear. And there was a pause, and then recognition and joy when he realized it was me. And I jumped out of the car as quickly as I could, and I realized that he didn't recognize me initially. I drive a very big truck. He just saw a truck and a person he didn't recognize pointing at him. And as I held him in a hug, he said 3 times, I was so scared. And we've talked about it since a lot, but he said, you know, he was scared because he's had years of random acts of verbal violence, anger, and bile directed at him from vehicles. And he thought he might be about to go through that trauma again in front of his daughter. And, you know, he's had people yell the N-word to him as they drive by him in town. And for no reason, they don't know him. It's nothing other than his skin color. And so he came to that encounter. He was in dad mode. He was trying to get his daughter into the car. He came to that encounter vulnerable because of very real traumas that he's experienced. And he wasn't anticipating needing in that moment to be ready. And he said to me, he said, I didn't know it was something going to go down. I didn't know what was going on. But it only lasted 2 seconds. And so I could jump out. I could hold him. I could apologize to him. And I could then reflect on what it meant to be see myself as a source of fear, because I don't consider myself to be a person who deserves to be a source of fear. But in that moment, what we were carrying was hundreds, thousands of interactions throughout his life and my life and the lived experience of being a person of color in Vermont. And so I am grateful for that experience, even as it sort of fuels me to seek social change and to be a better partner to the people of color who are struggling and suffering in Vermont for no reason other than our inability to acknowledge our own racist systems, our own racist behaviors, and to learn about how to be better.
Beverly, I want to invite you into this conversation, too. I know there are many of you in it. It's difficult to sort of have a conversation with all of us so far apart from one another physically, but I so value hearing each experience and appreciate that you may have some jumping off points from what Tristan Tolino was saying with this idea of acknowledging and realizing his privilege, but also the impact that so many small instances and large instances might have that then color every interaction that people have together. And I think you have some experiences to address that as well.
Yes, I do. You know, I came to Vermont 15 years ago, and my daughter asked me, how are you going to manage to live in a state that's so white? And I remember saying to her at that time, I don't think it's as white as it looks. And after a few years, I began to realize that I had been right. But finding people of color had been really hard up until that point. And my experience has been in a lot of microaggressions. You know, people will say to me, oh, are you Native American? You know, I have a Native American friend who lives in Washington State, and their name is such and such. Do you know them? You know, and I have to say, I don't know every Native person that lives on this land.
Mm-hmm.
I have people, you know, I've discovered that there are more Cherokee royalty in Vermont than any place I've ever lived, because everyone will say, oh, well, my grandmother was a Cherokee princess. My grandfather was a medicine man. He was Cherokee. You know, and the list goes on and on. And I don't know why they choose the Cherokee Nation to do that with, maybe because they've had such a hard time. But they really know nothing about their lineage, if they are, in fact, descendants. And I've also had a lot of difficulty in talking to people And recognizing that in the schools here, there are no teaching about true Native American tradition, what really happened in this country. You know, we're not taught American history. We're taught U.S. government history. And the people that were murdered and the genocide that occurred and the lands that were stolen and the treaties that weren't honored are never mentioned. And in the schools, you don't have people of color teaching our students or in the administration to really see that the curriculum is changed. And the school boards seem real hesitant to, you know, to do that. I think that that concerns me the most because, well, I'm 71 and I've had many years to learn and to study about the history of my Black sisters and brothers and you know, Native American peoples. Our children that are coming up today don't get that privilege.
And what does that erasure feel like? I mean, that's part of it, right, Beverly? It's an erasure. I mean, if the history is not being taught, then your background is not being expressed, and it's this sort of absence of you. And so, you know, what does that feel like then to live with that? Because, you know, some people might say, for example, well, yes, but when I would see you, I might say, oh, your people are so spiritual. Oh, you live so close to the land. That's an appreciation. What's so bad about that? But there's not, you know, there is a sense that who you are is not being valued.
Yes, that is true. And, you know, I do get a lot of comments like the ones that you just said. But in not knowing the real history, the real background to that, when I do get upset over something that's said or when I confront someone with the truth when they've believed a lie, I often get a lot of pushback. Mm. I've lost a really dear Jewish friend for 20 years because I responded and reacted to something that had happened. And she felt that I was attacking her as a Jewish woman because I said to her, she's, I don't identify as white. And I said, you may not identify as white by your skin color. I said, you fall into that class. And she didn't want to hear it. And most white people do not want to hear that they are racist. And they don't want to really look at it. And they don't want to own it because it means they're going to have to make change. And for some people, change is really painful. I feel sometimes that I am invisible. I am invited to be on boards. I'm invited to speak places. We have an Abenaki presence here in this state. And for the most part, they don't want to get involved in the political issues of racism and social justice. I believe, and this is my belief, that they're afraid that their recognition, their state recognition, can be taken away from them. And they fought a long time to be recognized.
Yeah, and there may be reasons why people don't, I mean, certainly reasons why people don't want to stand up and have that conversation or be responsible for that conversation. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today we're hearing about what racism in Vermont looks like and feels like. This isn't really a show where we're trying to identify the scope of the problem, like how racist is Vermont, or to parse the issue. We're mostly just talking about what people's experiences are and how they come to the table on this conversation. People of color who are telling us what they've felt, heard, seen, lived, and people who identify as white Vermonters about their own lived experience and how that shapes their worldview. Logan says, my response to does Bennington have a racism issue is we all have a racism issue. Have you ever found yourself saying the phrase, I'm not racist, but without hesitation, whatever you said next confirms you do, in fact, have racist ideologies. Does this make you racist? Yeah, it does. Claire in Proctor emailed in, for the first time in over 20 years of teaching in Vermont, I'm now hearing open comments in my class, relatively, quote, mild things, but things like, what's a black name versus a white name? And comments about, he'll get into college because he's black. I challenge them when I hear them, but I'm not sure exactly how to do so. Kids have said, we don't have to be politically correct anymore. I've called parents and in class use lines like, defend that, or where are your facts? But I'm not sure that I'm doing any good. In private conversations with a student, I'm more direct. And Jake Hem says, I was attacked by two white men because I was presumed to be a black guy in 2018 in Claremont, New Hampshire. I've reported the racial hate crime to the Claremont, New Hampshire Police Department, Claremont, New Hampshire Internal Affairs, the DOJ, the New Hampshire Governor's Office, ACLU, the Boston FBI, and other officials and agencies. Yet no one has provided assistance with addressing what happened. Racism in America is not the fault of our president, Donald Trump. Instead of pointing fingers of who is at fault, let's start fixing the problem. I live in an environment where there's not one black man or woman I associate with. I have to be very cautious to limit my time outside of my church, my employer, and my home to reduce the chance of exposure to racism by this community. Racism is the easiest problem to find in America, yet it's covered up by many blankets of deception. Let's do more than just voting for a change. Let's all be part of making America a great nation. We're talking today with Sha'an Mouliere, coordinator of I Am Vermont 2, an ongoing art project that aims at illuminating the perspective of Vermonters of color. Sha'an has also navigated the school system as a parent of a child who's faced racism. Connor Cyrus, a morning reporter for WCAX-TV, is with us. Beverly Little Thunder, a Lakota Two-Spirit elder and a board member of the Burlington-based Peace and Justice Center. And Tristan Tolino, a Brattleboro State representative who identifies as white and has been thinking about and talking about what he and other white Vermonters can do to address systemic racism. And again, you can share your perspective, your experiences, your questions by going to vpr.net and clicking on Vermont Edition, or by calling 800-639-2211. Lorraine is on the phone with us from St. Johnsbury. Lorraine, go right ahead.
Hi. First of all, I want to say hello, Cheyenne. It's really good to hear you on the radio. And I have a friend who spends the winters in Texas, and she grew up there, and she spends her summers in Vermont. And her view of racism in Vermont is that when she's in Texas, it's overt. You know it's there. You know who's a racist, who isn't. Everybody's out front about it. But in Vermont, everybody pretends not to be racist. But when you get really close to people and talk to them, there it is. So the real challenge is for us who are white and privileged is to look at that and acknowledge it. And get through our own denial about who we are. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the comment. Connor, you're right in front of me. I can see you nodding. So what does that mean for you?
Well, as somebody who grew up in Texas and then moved here, I completely can relate to just when people don't like you in Texas because of the color of your skin, you know why they don't like you. Here in Vermont, it's such a different picture because they will come up with every other excuse why they don't like you. When at the heart of the issue, it's because I'm black. And it was an odd thing to come to terms with when I moved up here, because the South is considered so friendly to your face, but then you don't quite know how they are behind your back. And Vermont and New Englanders are considered very blunt and upfront. But they are blunt and upfront until it comes to race. Mm-hmm. And then when it comes to race, people get very, especially here in Vermont, get very scared. Mm-hmm. And it becomes very taboo, and it becomes an awkward conversation because I think people don't know how to talk about it. And it's just, you know, I've noticed it, and it's one of those things that I myself am trying to navigate. How do I continue to talk about race? How do I continue to bring it up without being the angry black person that's always talking about race and always talking about social injustice?
Beverly, I heard you saying uh-huh as well to that. You that resonates for you?
It resonates for me. It definitely does. I was terminated from a job a few years back, and I couldn't understand why they came up with some excuses to terminate me. And then I realized that there had been a Native American client who was at the facility I worked at. I was a nurse, and I worked with pregnant and addicted mothers, and she'd asked me if I would come up to her room and pray with her in a Native tradition, and I did that. And after that, there was almost a total shutdown of communication with other employees there, and it was soon after that that I was terminated. And it's subtle, and sometimes it's hard to see, and nobody wants to admit that they're racist. Nobody wants to say, you know, that did come from a racist point of view. It's always, I'm not racist.
Mm-hmm.
How can you say, you know, I'm racist? I'm married to someone as of mixed blood.
Let me add an email that we got.
There are a couple of, I think, salient points that need to be highlighted. That for people of color, on some level, having to navigate, know that you're the problem. You know, that just your presence, being there, causes a problem.
Mm-hmm.
I'm currently reading Michelle Obama's Becoming, and I'm at the place where she's talking about her Princeton experience, which related very closely to me in Vermont, mm-hmm. in that you feel so isolated that people do not recognize the generational privileges and customs that they have. And Beverly had talked about schools, and we talk about moving forward and listening to be able to hear your own stories as opposed to the narrative of the dominant society. One of the things, bills that Kaya had worked on was the Ethnic and Equitable Studies Bill. Mm-hmm. And I'm on the Vermont Coalition for Ethnic and Social Equities in School. We have a bill now, H3, that are looking to create an equity standard advisory working group that can look at our ethnic and social education in schools. Thank you.
Yeah, you know.
Could I jump on that?
Yeah, let me read an email that we got, because I think this speaks to it as well. Mike actually posted on our Facebook page, the biggest issue about racism in Vermont that I see is that it's presumed to be behind any criticism or punitive action involving a person of color. Yes, there are some bigots here, but Vermonters, by and large, are fairly decent people and not racists. And, you know, this speaks, Tristan, I think you can jump in here on that, because one of the things that you were experiencing in the story you told earlier about how your actions were perceived by your friend who's African-American as potentially threatening until he knew who it was, is that, you know, in some cases it may be hard to tell, because if you've been subjected to microaggressions or to threatening behavior so many times, how would you not perceive any action as being about who you are at base or how you look? And so, you know, that's something to navigate as well. But go right ahead.
Yeah. So two things. One is that I wanted to affirm that the House is very interested in moving quite quickly on H3, which is the Ethnic and Social Equity Studies Standards. And that's one place where there is a policy lever that might make a difference. And we're very committed to seeing that through. And I think there will be testimony on it this week, if not this week, next week, in the House Education Committee. But it is a high priority for the House leadership team and for Speaker Johnson. And we want to see this get done. And it's part of our promise to Kaya to learn from what we've all been going through for the last year. But I wanted to pivot back to the email in about, you know, there are bigots, but that doesn't mean everyone is racist. And I actually think that is the crux of the problem for white America, and particularly for Vermont, where we haven't had much practice with racial stress and racial communication, and we don't have much stamina or skillfulness in navigating these conversations. And we've accepted a definition of that a racist is a person who is bigoted and mean and awful and a bad person. And I think that's actually a bad definition. And that's why I started off by saying that, you know, of course I'm racist, because I've been socialized into a racist system that privileges white power and particularly white male power. And it's not – I have to learn the way that my tendency towards bias and then discrimination shows up in my life, but I also have to learn what it means to be socialized in a racist system. And what happens is that when people believe that racists are people who are awful, then any conversation, any person of color who tries to say this interaction or this comment wasn't particularly race-free, it was problematic, instead of being able to be vulnerable and say thank you for sharing with me something that I can now learn and get better, we get defensive because we think I'm not racist because racists are bad and bigoted people. And so it allows us to define ourselves away from responsibility. And it invalidates the learning opportunity that's being offered by the person of color to us. And when their experience of doing that hundreds, thousands of times in their lifetime, and they get the same sort of white solidarity window of or wall of like, I'm not a bad person, how dare you accuse me, and nothing changes, it, you know, how could anybody not be angry? To be living and experiencing that, and yet they're not allowed to be angry, because if they're angry, then we can criticize and prevent ourselves from having to address the substantive critique by saying, well, why are you coming at me with anger? That wasn't me. I didn't do this. I'm not a bad person. And we have to change that completely. We have to start over and acknowledge that a white Vermont is part of a white majority culture in the United States, and it's centuries old, and it will take a lot of effort and deliberate effort to structurally change it and to change the way that we function within it. And we have to acknowledge our own racism as part of that. Have to.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Today we're looking at what it's like to experience racism in Vermont, and we're giving time and space, depending on our own personal life experiences, to share the feelings of being a target of racism, or as those who've perpetuated racism or racial bias, to feel empathy, to feel anger, perhaps to feel confusion. The aim is to use personal experience to open a dialogue, to sort of crack open a conversation. We're not explicitly debating policy. This is supposed to feel more like a conversation, a personal conversation. I wish that it could last more than 1 hour, maybe 2 hours, maybe 7 hours. Joanne in Berkshire said, I'm white. Back in the 90s, I was on the Stowe bike pass with a group, including a 10-year-old black boy who regularly stayed with me through the Fresh Air program. A young white man in his early 20s in the oncoming lane turned and called the N-word after the boy. Fortunately, the slur didn't reach the ears of its target, but I heard it. I stopped my bike in its tracks, filled with rage. I've thought of myself as a pacifist all my life, but the shock and anger of that moment, I found myself wanting to turn around and go after this jerk. Not only was this racism here in my beloved Vermont, but it was directed at a child by an adult. It is burned vividly in my memory, and it shed a tiny bit of light on what it must feel like to face this throughout your life. We're talking today with Beverly Little Thunder, a Lakota Two-Spirit elder and board member of the Burlington-based Peace and Justice Center, Connor Cyrus, a morning reporter for WCAX-TV, Sha'an Moliere, coordinator of I Am Vermont 2, and Tristan Tolino, a Brattleboro State representative who's been sharing his experience. And we're hearing from some of you as well, as we just heard, trying to have a conversation here about racism and what it feels like. And Connor, one of the things that I know that you wanted to bring up and bring into this conversation, and maybe we can get some responses as well, is just the sheer exhaustion and the stress of dealing with this, and how, you know, even something small, when it's perpetuated all of the time, can really impact your life.
That's right. And I want to start out by saying that I don't think that black people, especially here in Vermont, I don't think we're angry. I think we're frustrated because we deal with this on a regular basis. So while white people, while this conversation might be new, while it might be something that you touch upon a couple times a year, this is something we deal with all the time. So this is nothing new for us. This is something that we wake up, we're black. We live our lives, we're black. We go to sleep, we're black. So this is something that we deal with all the time. But it's just like, what's exhausting is we're constantly being bombarded with we're black. I don't want to be defined by my blackness. I want to be defined by my character, by who I am as a person, and what I offer society. By constantly being told, oh, you're black, defend your blackness, that's exhausting. That can be something as simple as somebody touching my hair because they've never touched black hair, somebody touching my skin because they've never touched it and saying, oh my God, your skin is so soft, it feels just like mine. Well, duh, I'm human. You know, it's like, you know, and there's these, you know, and there's these other things, there's all these things that we deal with on a regular basis. I mean, on the regular, I will cross the street and I will hear somebody lock their car doors. That's not an uncommon sound for me to hear. And I know why they're doing it. I can be dressed in a suit after work, and I'll still hear that versus me in a hoodie. And so being bombarded by these sorts of things and knowing that I might be driving down the street to a story. It's Vermont. We get lots of snow. We have very spotty cell service. I know that I have to think twice about knocking on a door if my car dies or if I go off a ditch because I don't know who's gonna answer the door. Those are the kinds of stressors that we as Black people in Vermont deal with that need to be addressed because it's hard for us to live our lives when we are constantly bombarded with our Blackness.
Sha'an, you want to jump in here?
I do. And one of my remedies has been to engage with more people of color. I am so blessed to be part of the People of Color Caucus. I am a different person. It is the one time I'm not thinking about my Blackness, having conversations with others. One of our themes were that we always felt outside. We felt like the other. And being able to come together for our own nurturing, for our own well-being, I think our well-being is an act of liberation. We don't have the healthcare providers that are out there that can take care of us. Most of our practitioners are white. So we are in the process of taking care of each other in those ways that lift us up, economically, that lift us up spiritually, that lift us up as a community.
Beverly Little Thunder, I want to make sure we have some time for you to offer a thought. As I said, I wish this was a longer program because it's, you know, you can skim the surface. But what are you thinking here about, you know?
Well, what I'm thinking about is that, you know, going back to this gentleman who said not all Vermonters are racist. Well, all Vermonters are racist. Mm-hmm. And they can't help but be racist. And there are opportunities for them to learn about that. You know, Peace and Justice has a program that they go around the state offering on racism. And it used to be called White Fragility. And it was based on a book by Robin DiAngelo, who studied it. And people were offended. People came to it and were offended and said, you know, we're not fragile. So we've changed it to disrupting racism. And it starts a conversation for people to look at the things that they say and do and to know how to stop that, to disrupt that kind of behavior and hopefully teach someone else how to disrupt their racist behavior and to not feel guilty about being racist.
Or being called out about it.
Or being called out about it. It does not mean you're a bad person. And for me, I won't call someone out unless I do like them, unless I do care about them. And so that's why it was such a shock, you know, when I lost this 20-year friend. And I still grieve it.
Yeah, Beverly, you make an interesting point, too, about when it's worth your time and your effort to have that conversation and to call someone out. And I want to thank all four of you for being involved in this conversation because it is important to sort of crack that open. Some Vermonters are having a lot of these conversations, are really grappling, and some aren't. And so I appreciate you being willing, in this case, to take that effort and have that conversation. It's a privilege to be a part of it. Beverly Little Thunder, Connor Cyrus, Sha'an Moliere, and Tristan Tolino, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.